Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. Each weekday morning, Roundtable host Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from some of these conversations. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are available online at WAMC.org, in the WAMC app, and wherever you get your podcasts. On Tuesday, June 17th, Joe was joined by Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, Corporate Attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Let us begin with the President at the G7, although he's not there anymore. Trump signed the G7 statement backing Israel and criticizing Iran after discussions with other leaders and changes to the initial draft, and then announced that he was abruptly leaving the summit to attend to the conflict between Israel and Iran. The White House announced this late Monday. Trump called for a broader de-escalation of hostilities in the Middle East in a statement with other global leaders. Trump initially declined to sign the G7 statement, but reversed his position following discussions with other leaders in the group and changes to the initial draft. That, according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the sensitive conversations. The official declined to say what changes secured Trump's sign-off, but the statement omitted language that called for both Iran and Israel to show restraint, which appeared in an earlier draft of the agreement viewed by the Washington Post. The published statement affirmed Israel's right to defend itself and called Iran the principal source of regional instability and terror. It also reiterated that Iran cannot possess a nuclear weapon, and again, that from the Washington Post. Judy.
It's difficult to ascertain what the current administration's position is on what's happening in the Middle East. Are they supporting regime change, or are we just pursuing getting rid of the nuclear weapons that Iran is trying to develop? It seems like it's back and forth. I agree with everybody that we want to de-escalate the situation in the Middle East. My whole life we've tried to do this, but at this point it seems like Israel is lobbying for regime change. And the question is, what follows? What's next? Because there's not some sort of good guy operative working in Iran that's going to come to the rescue and bring peace to the Middle East through a defanged Iran. That's my concern, and I just wish when I turn to the U.S., the president's press secretary, or I turn on the television, that I would get, as a citizen of the United States, a clear understanding of where America stands on this.
How could you not understand it? I think Trump and his team have been nothing but clear, not just during this crisis, and I see the looks of incredulousness on the face of the panel, but not just during this crisis, but the previous crises. Yeah, he's very clear.
The eyes did sort of say, hmm?
Yeah. that they should never have a nuclear. They should never have a nuclear program. I don't think he's ever, and I don't listen to every word in the news, but I don't think he's ever. Trump has ever affirmatively called for regime change. I think he, in fact, I thought he had gone out of his way to say, look, we're not here to impose, regime change on anybody, in other contexts as well. I think whatever can be done to get that country to not have a nuclear weapons program is what he is in favor of doing. He would have preferred, and I think he would still prefer to do it by some kind of negotiation. And I think now he's faced with the difficult choice. But I don't think regime change was ever something that he was openly advocating.
When he was pursuing these negotiations with Iran, though, wasn't there some sort of coordination needed with the State of Israel so that they wouldn't start, they wouldn't interrupt the effort to have a negotiation?
Yeah, and they held off for quite some time, and they've held off, if you could believe, look, I'm not in the conversations, but, if you could try and parse from what's reported, it sounds like they held off for some amount of time. He gave Iran the whatever the 60 days, or there was no appreciable change in negotiations. I understand that there's different views on what the intelligence findings. You know, the Israelis said it's days away, and the U.S. intelligence, looking at really the same information, said no, they're years away. So I understand that, but no, I think that he quietly asked the Israelis to hold off for a while. I think the idea of them not taking out the Ayatollah, whether that's his idea or their idea, that kind of seems like the right way to go.
So, you know, I've been paying a lot of attention to this, obviously. The role of the U.S. in this has been very, very unclear. I mean, it's clearly been a lot of stuff that's been happening out of sight. You know, it's hard to believe Netanyahu would have gone ahead with this without at least a tacit agreement from the U.S. Trump said publicly, you know, I didn't know about it. Privately, then later he sort of said, well, yeah. You know, it's the same thing we often get out of the White House now, where you can't quite figure it out. You know, he left the G7, quote, to deal with this situation, unquote. Yet I can find nothing he actually did when he came back, except to send two messages on Truth Social, which actually somewhat contradicted each other. So, you know, it's really hard to call it. But I did think that some of the reporting out of the G7 was very interesting, because in the past, he's usually come out of it with a very hostile reception from everyone else. And this time, I would say it was mixed. I mean, there were definitely people who said, you know, it was like a Trump who was willing to talk to them, that he actually didn't just come in and say my way or the highway. I hate to say anything nice about Trump, but, you know, it's unclear what was going on here. I mean, Canada, he had side meetings and is apparently working on the tariff issue. We don't know what the statement was before and after, but it was clear that it was signed off in a way that, you know, it's a fairly neutral statement, and he signed off on it. So it seems like somebody has convinced him that the international world is something that he needs to at least be aware of.
JP, we got about a minute and a half.
So there is a battle within, I think, the Trump White House right now, which is, do they go and help the Israelis dismantle the nuclear facility in Fordow, which if you read the New York Times this morning, they say that only the United States has the capability to do that. Israelis do not have the bombs nor the planes to do that. And so Trump is in a unique position in that he ran on an anti-interventionalist foreign policy platform that is different than Republicans have run on over the last 30 years. He also is very close to Netanyahu and Israel and the Jewish community in the United States. So those seem to be two key groups for him, and he has to make this decision, which is super important. And there are repercussions, which, you know, we're not in those security briefings, so we don't know what repercussions he's being warned about. And Iran, of course, we've been hearing about their nuclear ambitions for 30 years. It's amazing to me that they haven't put together a nuclear bomb. But I think that it's very possible that Trump himself doesn't know which way he's going to go at this fork in the road, whether he's going to help dismantle the nuclear facilities militarily in Fordow, or whether he is going to tell the Israelis, you have my blessing to do what you want, but we at this time are not going to be involved.
Yeah. And well, I think that's what he went home to do.
Did I cut you off, JP, or were you?
I was about my whole thought.
And then Rich?
That was my whole thought.
All right. Anybody want to add anything before we go to listener letters? All right. haven't been on in 2 weeks. You need have more to say. Diane said the bottom line is that Trump wants the Nobel Prize for Peace so badly that he will do whatever he thinks will get him this. Well, that seems cynical, but
if that's true, so what? that he'll do anything to get
the
peace.
The idea is peace. Yeah, that's a good point, Rich. But yes.
He could join Yasser Arafat, right, with other Nobel Peace Prize winners.
Go ahead.
Well, my concern would be that he would sell out Ukraine and Zelensky for the sake of a fake peace. There are other nefarious ways maybe to get a Nobel Prize, a prize for peace. I agree it's a noble crusade on his part, incredibly unsuccessful so far. I thought there'd be no wars when Donald Trump was elected. He'd be such a powerful person, there'd be no wars. But apparently there's a war in the Middle East at this point, and the continuing war in Ukraine.
Yeah, both of which didn't happen on his watch.
You mean what's happened in the Middle East right now is not on his watch? What's happening in Iran is not in his watch?
Well, it's an outgrowth of what happened in October.
Everything's an outgrowth of things that happened 100 years ago as well.
Well, not that many years ago. I think a lot of this is an outgrowth of what happened when, Barack Obama tried really hard to do a deal with Iran, and we're still paying the price for that.
Okay, so on that, we go to this letter, which just proves that the listeners have just been percolating while we've been away. Andrew says, didn't we have a deal limiting nuclear development in Iran? What idiot president got rid of that because a black guy signed it? Are your memories really that shot? Asks Andrew.
And does anybody really need to point out that deal was not a deal? And that deal probably paved the way for them to get more updated centrifuges than they had before. And that deal did nothing to stop them from being the worldwide sponsor of terrorism. And I'll stand by my statement. We're still paying for that deal, as well as the relaxation of sanctions against Iran during what do we call it now, the Jill Biden administration, but whatever administration was in place last, which was also not helpful to this process.
We just got to shake our heads here.
Yeah, I'll simply say I don't agree, but okay. And leave it like that.
Vincent writes, it should be noted that Netanyahu and company were very much against the nuclear deal that Obama had put together with Iran and have done everything possible since then to diminish the possibility of it being resurrected. Are we really sanctioning the bombing of other countries and killing their leaders every time we disagree with them and their ideology? That from Vincent.
This one I actually think is different, and I may even end up agreeing with Rich on this. We'll see. But, several months ago, before the Trump administration, I was listening to one of the many sources I listened to on this, and they were saying that, actually one of the things they believed the Trump administration was going to try very hard to establish was not so much regime change, but you have a population in Iran who do not particularly like their government. They've had lots of big demonstrations of things and felt that you now had some of the other countries there, the Saudi Arabias, and who would not get involved in an Israel-Iran contest. And also that Trump has now gone out of his way to make deals with a lot of those countries. So in fact, the thing that could have blown up into a Mideast-wide conflict seems much less likely to do so. It now becomes much more of a two-country and some supporting actors. You still have the Gaza situation. Hezbollah is saying, we're going to take our revenge, but Hezbollah was very heavily
degraded.
I don't know what word to use. Disarmed, degraded. Yeah. Degraded's the better word, yeah. It's really been a kind of tacit relationship between the U.S. and Israel on the Iran and the North. And then you had, sort of Syria taking care of itself. You have Lebanon virtually a non-player at the moment. So you know, it seemed like a lot of people were saying that we know that you're going to see Israel backed by the U.S. probably tacitly going in and trying to not so much do regime change, but to reduce the threat of Iran as that sponsor of terrorism around the curve, the arc of the region.
Anybody else?
Well, and specifically the nuclear facility, you know, they've taken out, according to reports, like the top 9 or 10 nuclear scientists in Iran. And I do think that going forward, you know, we talk about previous deals, even going forward, I don't understand how the United States, you know, negotiates with Iran on this in terms of believing what they say. You know, they are, you know, they support terrorists. You'd say, you know, they're terrorists. How do you negotiate with a terrorist? I would imagine, you know, they say that they want IAEA inspectors to go into Fordo to make sure that they dismantle their facility there. But why is Iran, who is going to spend tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars building this facility, going to go and dismantle it? You know, what I would want them to have Iran say, we're moving all of our people out and you can bomb it on your own and destroy it yourself. I don't understand how a deal is going to be reached going forward where the United States or Israel has a confidence that they are going to abandon their nuclear ambitions, which they've been working on for at least the past 30 or 40 years.
Rachel writes to us and says, please do not characterize Trump as being close to the Jewish people. He has made his living in this country more, He has made living in this country more dangerous for Jews while using the Jewish people as an excuse to stomp civil rights of others. Also, he loves him some white supremacists. That from...
you know, I see Rich shaking his head and I'm nodding.
I don't even know why you read that crap, Joe. I really don't.
So, you know what? Rich, I've been both in the classified world and the unclassified world watching this stuff, and the white supremacist movement has grown significantly during the two Trump administrations and much less in between. Now, cause, effect, we can get into a lot of conversation, but there has been, again, at least tacit support. I mean, a lot of the people who were pardoned for January 6th were very clearly anti-Jewish. And so, you know, I mean, it's you can argue a lot of different ways on this, but I think to say that Trump has been a friend of the Jews is not fair. To say that Trump has a relationship with Netanyahu in Israel is a different statement.
Yeah, I don't think there's as much daylight between being, and I know people on the left try to say that there is. I don't think there's as much daylight between being a friend of Israel and being a friend of the Jewish people as those on the far left would have us believe. I think that being a friend of Israel is being a friend to the Jewish people. And when I look at what the, you know, what the Biden and Obama administrations did, not only their antipathy towards Israel, but their tolerance of what I consider to be viciously anti-Semitic rhetoric throughout academic institutions in which they had a great degree of power. I don't see how you could. I think Trump is much more friendly to not only Israel, but to the Jewish people than certainly the Biden administration ever was.
Yeah.
And when I was characterizing it, it was just that he views that as a constituency of his, right? He has supporters who are pro-Israel and who are Jewish. And not to say that he's, to characterize him as a friend or foe, but I think he views that as a constituency of his. Would you say that's fair?
I don't think I disagree with that, yeah. But I will tell you, as president of a synagogue, we went from balanced budgets to major, major fundraising to be able to afford the security we need that, you know, was partly because of Gaza, but was a lot because of how that's played out over time. And the U.S. could have made significantly different decisions, both under Biden and Trump, but especially in the past few months, where I think things started moving in positive directions, and then it's been move, stop, two steps forward, one step back. I mean, it's a terrible situation for everybody, and I think Trump, largely by ignoring it in public, has made it worse.
Jim Hendler on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, June 17th. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details or facts may have changed since our live broadcasts earlier in the week. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, June 18th, Joe Donahue was joined for the Roundtable panel by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer.
Here's where we begin, and that is the international news and about war and very concerning news that comes to us. And we'll do our best to look at what is the most recent elements here and the going back and forth, which, of course, makes it even more difficult to kind of get your handle on it. So first, we'll talk about the U.S. debating the bombing of Iran and of that decision, which could pull the country into a major war or lead to the destruction of Iran's nuclear program. That'll be one segment of our conversation. And then separately, I would like to talk about of how the president shifted on Iran under pressure from Israel, and look at that aspect of the story as well, which I think is a big part of the story. Of course, there was the G7 taking place in Alberta. The president left early to deal with these issues, and then was very cagey as to why, and that was a whole thing as well. So we'll work our way through as much of it as we possibly can. But we begin with the news that comes to us that and this, it was a back and forth really the yesterday and for a while, quite frankly, with the G7 agreement. There wasn't the president said he wasn't going to sign it, and then did before he got on Air Force One and took off for Washington, but from the Washington Post, President Donald Trump faced one of the most monumental decisions of his presidency as he debated whether to join a war against Iran that risked sucking Washington into a new Middle Eastern conflict, but also offered the chance to eliminate a foe's nuclear program. In a string of social media posts across the day, the president said that the United States has, quote, complete and total controls of the skies over Iran, warned Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Am I saying that correct, Jim?
Yeah, I think.
Khamenei. That he was an easy target and demanded, quote, shouty cap, unconditional surrender without defining what that is or what that means. As the day closed, and after an 80-minute meeting with top aides in the Situation Room, he spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to a White House official. The tough language came at a moment of extraordinary weakness for Tehran, whose power is at a low ebb following a year of Israeli attacks against its allies and proxies in the Middle East. Trump has long taken an aggressive approach toward Iran, although he also campaigned on ending global conflicts and as recently as last week continued to seek a new agreement to restrict its nuclear program, you know, to come up with a nuclear deal with Iran.
Who would have thought?
Yes. Mm. Bob Griffin.
There's so many facets to this story, Joe, and I know you sort of laid out a very logical two steps, but they really do blend. The war itself and some of the language that's coming out of the United States is really bothersome to me. For our president to be calling for unconditional surrender in a conflict between Israel and Iran, I thought elevated our role. And sort of the first question that comes to everybody's mind is, you know, what role is the United States going to play? And our language of what our language certainly appears like we have taken positions. Certainly, we're moving resources, military resources into the region, which raises another constitutional crisis that we could be facing about where are the War Powers Act and where is Congress. So let me sort of put that as a parking lot issue that we have to talk about. The right of the president to unilaterally involve us in an armed conflict without Congress. The other issue that I'm watching. A couple other issues I'm watching really carefully is one is that the extent of Israel's control over the airspace, particularly over Tehran, is stunning and I think sends some very, very interesting messages. But I will caution everybody before they get very excited about this. We had this type of technological superiority in other wars, which caused the shift in thinking to asymmetrical warfare, which got us into these never-ending wars. And this has the potential to make what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan pale in comparison. So when you start to think about eliminating the threat of the Iranian nuclear program, we by nature, in order to consider that to be successful, the main site at Fordo, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, Fordo, it's deep within a mountain. The only munitions that will work are munitions that the United States has, but it's not that easy. It's not that easy to say to Israel, we're going to slip you a couple of big bombs and you can go keep doing what you're doing. The only delivery of that weaponry would be United States planes, which means that if we're going to, through military means, eliminate the nuclear program in Iran, that we will have to get involved militarily, which is a huge step that has enormous implications. So when you start to think about you know cheering on Israel and you know you go Israel you're doing the right thing and we're going to sort of pretend that we're not involved. We can't pretend we're not involved if we're going to take those steps. In addition, I will also toss this out that if we do use the type of munitions that we're talking about at this site, then basically we're going to end up releasing what's the equivalent of a dirty bomb on the world because there is so much product that is on site that's another whole catastrophe in the making. The couple other issues, and I'll turn it over to the other panel. I'm really concerned that Trump is being stampeded here. There's a lot of reporting. I think we're going to talk about that he's setting policy based off of Fox News, which we knew and feared. But certainly, it feels like the position is changing simply because Israel is winning so strongly, and he always likes to align himself with the winner. It's causing a massive divide, not really between the Democrats and Republicans, but within the MAGA world. I was fascinated by the Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz shouting match, which we should really talk about. And it's coming at a time where I don't think we're spending enough time being honest about Trump's cognitive decline, the fact that his cabinet is among the weakest that I have ever seen. And we would potentially going into war with a significantly weakened U.S. government. And if you think about all of the effects of DOGE, we have weakened the infrastructure of our federal government. So there's a lot of issues on the table here.
Jim Ketter.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple quick things in response, or just jumping off of things that Bob said, and then maybe I could step back and give some context as well. First off, with Trump and the kinds of things that he's saying, when he says he's always a master of saying the quiet part out loud. And there are certain things in the federal government, particularly in national security, that are quiet by design. So when he says we know where the supreme leader is, this violates one of the core tenets of information, which is you're essentially revealing sources and methods when you say that. You're saying to a very dangerous adversary, we have the ability right now to know this. And so, number one, you just don't want to tip your hand. Number two, if you're the Iranians, if you weren't onto it already, then you want to say, how do they know this? And they will reverse engineer it, and any kind of human or technological means, and probably a combination that allows us to do that, will be destroyed. And so that the fact that he says these things, I mean, there are on occasion strategic reasons to say such things or to release such things. I mean, the Biden administration kind of strategically released information about our knowledge of Russian capabilities in Ukraine to put them on their back foot, but I don't think that's this. Second, I would just say it's really not a binary thing about, like, are we in or not? Now, obviously, as Bob said, it certainly crosses a line in terms of the use of military force. But we are essentially supporting Israel to do all of this. They're the largest recipient of U.S. foreign assistance, well over $3 billion a year. Most of that is military assistance. And so they would not be doing any of this without our assistance. So we are in already in many different ways. In terms of the role of Congress, this is a long tail of both parties and many administrations, really since the Korean War, granting again and again and again these kinds of powers to a presidency, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, in 2001 after 9/11, the authorization of the use of military force, which was the largest blank check you can imagine that was used for any number of things. Somebody who really was very thoughtful on this issue was former Congressman Chris Gibson. And when he was in Congress, he wrote a book, also, PhD, former professor, former college president, very thoughtful on this. But right now we see and we hear, particularly on the Republican side, but the long history of this is not just Republican, granting presidents this kind of power. Also, to the point of the infrastructure of our government and also of our diplomatic corps. So at this moment, this is the kind of moment when you would be relying, the president would be relying on the U.S. ambassador to Israel and that ambassador's immediate staff for clear, sober, thoughtful, and informed analysis. And the ambassador Huckabee recently sent a message to President Trump saying that president would be getting messages from heaven on this, and that's not really out of the, and I'm not making that up.
No, you're not.
And that's not really out of the State Department training playbook in general. So there's that. Another thing is, if the U.S. were to engage in this military action, it would have to face the same test that Israel would have to face internationally, and that is, is this a preemptive war or is this a preventive war? And that's not just words that kind of mean the same thing. They mean something decidedly different. A preemptive war means there is an imminent threat. Netanyahu has been trying very hard to have it appear that there has been an imminent threat from Iran. I mean, I have no sympathy for the Iranian regime. I have huge sympathy for the Iranian people. But the Iranian regime is a dangerous and toxic regime. That having been said, there's no evidence that they were on the verge of doing something with nuclear weapons. And so that makes it a preventive war, which is a violation of international law. And if we also engage in a preventive war, that would be a violation of international law. Now, that all sounds very quaint, and I don't know if anybody really cares about that sort of thing anymore, but I do. And I'm betting there's a few people in the listening audience, and I think there's quite a few people at the G7 and other places who care about that. So I have so much else to say, but let me just leave it at that and turn it over to my other panelists. I'm really interested to hear what they have to say.
Just a quick shout out. This event, unfortunately, is sold out, but I'm going to be in conversation with Chris Gibson tonight at the Kinderhook Bookstore. And he has a new book out called The Spirit of Philadelphia, which is this perspective on America's story told through the history of
You might
ideas.
Ask Chris about war powers, too.
We'll talk about that, I am sure. So, that is tonight. It is sold out, but anyway.
Right. We didn't even tee that up. I didn't
but
even
we
know.
We are going to be recording, and we'll be broadcasting it here on our little radio show. Jay Jochnowitz, go ahead.
So, you know, it's where to start. And then it just kind of opens up as both of you demonstrated. It's like you start on one thing and you move into all the other nuances of this. You know, the place I start, I start in a couple of places. One is we would not be in this situation if the president had not canceled a not perfect, arguably imperfect in one key way, deal with Iran. And, you know, many people felt we should have negotiated, we and others, other nations, should have negotiated a deal that got them out of the business of terrorism altogether. That was not going to happen with the Iranian regime. So they got a deal that held this off for 10 years. And again, not perfect, but it offered an opportunity, as I think I wrote about this some years ago, that it gave an opportunity for Iran to join the community of nations and to show the Iranian people, the Iranian civilian, non-religious leadership, that there was another path to dealing with the world, to approaching the world. You could get rid of your revolutionary mindset, which I think a lot of Iranian people want to do. And already have done, and as I said, join the community of nations. So we would, that's hindsight at this point. The complete and total surrender or the complete and total control of the airspace is such a Trumpian thing to say. He gives the other time he likes to use that phrase is when he's giving endorsements to people. Subject, always subject to change, as this is subject to change. And I think the warning you point out that this is, that we have some sort of such overwhelming military superiority here that if we drop our bunker buster on Fordo or a number of them, that somehow that's it. That's the game's over. We've won. Iran's going to be devastated. Nothing to worry about after that. It is such hubris. We have had the superiority for years, and once we get out of an air war and into a ground war, we're in a whole different situation. We have an extraordinarily well armed and capable ground force to deal with in Iran, and that's not. And we have allies who are telling us this is not the way we want to see this resolved. I'd like to see Israel win this, quite frankly. I'd like to not have another belligerent nuclear power in the world, especially in the Middle East. But I don't know that that's possible. And when we talk more about the Trump manipulation aspect of this. I do think he's being steamrolled in the sense that Trump is always steamrolled. What he does is he sees a situation and then he tries to figure out what is the best way he can look the best in this situation. And we're at a point almost, and I think that's why he's holding off on Fordo, is that he doesn't quite own it yet. But he's going to own it if we drop a bomb.
Jay Jochnowitz on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, June 18th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, June 20th, the Roundtable panelists were partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, Alexander Mihailovic, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
We're basically going to pick up where we left off on Wednesday. And that is the options for the United States regarding Iran. And what really has changed now from Wednesday was in regards to the president, will he, won't he, of what the position was going to be. Now the president appears to have bought himself some time and is opening up some new options by doing that. The president appears to be offering one more off-ramp to the Iranians, and he is also bolstering his own military options. The sudden announcement that he could take up to 2 weeks to decide whether to plunge the United States into the heart of the Israel-Iran conflict is being advertised by the White House as giving diplomacy one more chance to work. But it also opens a host of new military and covert options. Assuming he makes full use of it, Mr. Trump will now have time to determine whether 6 days of relentless bombing and killing by Israeli forces, which has taken out one of Iran's two biggest uranium enrichment centers, much of its missile fleet, and its most senior officers and nuclear scientists, has changed minds in Tehran. The deal that was rejected earlier this month by the Ayatollah would have cut off Iran's main pathway to a bomb by eventually ending enrichment on uranium soil. May look very different now than one of its largest nuclear centers has been badly damaged, and the president is openly considering dropping the world's largest conventional weapon on the second, or it may simply harden the Iranians' resolve not to give in. I will, just because at heart I am a cynical journalist, so I will say that at heart there is a great article in the New York Times today as well about this 2 week time frame that the president, over his time in office as both the 45th and 47th president, has used time and time again, that it's just sort of it's a bookmark, it's a placeholder, and it can be 2 weeks, it could be 2 days, it could be never, and but it is a time frame. And I say that not so much as a criticism, but I think just as an understanding that this has a lot of wiggle room in it, that I don't think we're going to see, you know, we're not going to be watching the clock and say, oh, you know, we have 11 hours left until the 2 weeks is up to make a decision. So that is where we are at this very moment. Alexander, let's begin with you.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about this moment is the the way in which this shows up some of the fissures within the Republican Party. And also, by extension, I think Netanyahu's ruling coalition. Because one of the things that I think is important to bear in mind is that already in May, Trump nixed the idea of an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities. This was something that Netanyahu wanted him to do, but he very emphatically said to Netanyahu, no, this is a very poor idea. So in some sense, what's happened is that this supposed coalition between Netanyahu and Trump is a little bit more precarious than we might think. This also points to something else within Israeli politics, which is that there is widespread dissatisfaction among the Israeli public with Netanyahu's policies. And in fact, 70% of the population would like to see him no longer be president in the next election. Right. I just want to add a little bit more to this, before passing it on to other people here. The other aspect of this is the fissures within the Republican Party. Normally, the defense of Israel, its right to exist, has been a kind of a hardcore Republican position. However, right now we're seeing some tension among certain people in the party who are very important, such as J.D. Vance, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and also some of the libertarians, such as Laurent Paul, who do not want to see an American military involvement, and who also, are trying to appeal. I have to cut to the chase here, to the anti-Semitic wing of the MAGA movement, which sees Israel as constantly being a vector for the United States' historical nation-building policies. So there's this kind of split between the nativist isolationist wing and with the so-called pro-Israel wing of the Republican Party, which has become more pronounced just within the last couple of days. Where it will go, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see.
Sienna.
I mean, we're watching that riff right now. We all saw it on, we all know, everyone knows there's 92 million, and the population in Iran is 92 million based on that Tucker Carlson interview. So, I mean, that's been going, viral, watching what's happening within the Republican Party. But on it, from an immigration perspective, I just think about what will happen if we move forward with this and bomb Iran. What happens then? And I can't help but think about what happened in Afghanistan and what happened, what were the implications there as we speak right now? After that, 20 or so skirmish war, what have you, in Afghanistan, now they're on our ban list for immigration. And they're no longer allowed to come into the U.S. except for a few exceptions. So I just kind of worry about whether there will be any kind of, I've heard the phrase used and I like it, positive political transformation if this happens. What are the long-term implications of this if this happens? And that's what I think about, on a long-term basis after we've seen what's happened with in Afghanistan and with the Afghans and what's happened here in the U.S. and reflection. And because of that, I just keep thinking about what happens if we bomb this nation long-term. Will there be political transformation or not?
Yeah, I'll jump in and say that the politics of this are a second-order concern for me, at the very least. I'm probably more hawkish on this than just about any foreign policy thing that I can think of. It is absolutely in America's best interest to never live to see a day, any of us live to see a day, with a nuclear-armed Iran. And this is not a new point for me. This has been, a hardcore belief of mine for a very, very long time. Alex, you were talking about the Republican coalition. That's kind of fascinating to me as well. You're hearing, and look, I'll be blunt. I don't take people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson very seriously at all. That said, I think there's been a lot of overwrought commentary about how, this is fracturing the MAGA coalition, et cetera. Trump promised not to get us into forever wars. This doesn't feel like a forever war to me. This feels to me like a strategic strike. In other words, and by the way, Joe, within 2 weeks, this could look incredibly differently. I mean, within 2 weeks, you might be able to dismantle the Iranian nuclear program with a socket wrench and a pair of pliers at the rate this is going.
Well, and the president made that very clear, I think, on prior to saying 2 weeks, when he spoke on Wednesday and said, we're a long way from where we were one week ago.
Exactly.
And so it's a fair point of where we're going to be in 2 weeks.
Yeah, but the idea, you know, you're hearing the Powell doctrine invoked, you know, you break it, you buy it. I don't see any strategic interest here, frankly, and I don't hear any rhetoric coming out of Trump or others about regime change. This is not about regime change. This is about stopping the Iranian nuclear program, period, full stop.
But are you saying that you think we've learned the lessons of Iraq, we've learned the lessons of Afghanistan, so there won't be any of these long-term implications
in the past? No, sorry to interrupt. I'm merely saying that this is a different set of facts on the ground than in those conflicts. Iraq was correct me if I'm wrong, it was a deliberate attempt at regime change. This is not that. This is about creating a safer world.
Yeah, I take your point about that this is not about regime change. I mean, there are some of the statements that the Trump administration has issued would seem, you know, kind of, you know, tip the hat in that direction a little bit, but it's very perfunctory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly not their main agenda. The main agenda is international security, so it seems, for the Trump administration. And giving credit where credit is due, they're trying to force the issue of a long festering wound in international security issues vis-a-vis Iran. Right? It is a profoundly, deeply anti-Semitic country. You know, in terms of its policy.
No question.
I'm not talking about the population. I'm speaking about, you know, the official foreign policy of the country. So there's that to take and bear in mind. And, you know, some people such as Elliot Cohen, you know, who had served, in, you know, as security advisors for various Democratic administrations have said, look, you know, we have to admit that, you know, this is a form of legitimate statementship that Trump is engaging in, albeit it's in his own very belligerent theatrical version, you know.
You think?
So now there are a couple of other things that what complicates this is also, and this is probably a discussion that's going to bleed into our conversation about, you know, Russian and Israeli policy towards Iran, is that Iran is a conventional weapons powerhouse in terms of its technology. It really wants, so like the last step in its security, you know, profile is to have access to nuclear weapons. And what Trump has been suggesting is that he would draw perhaps the largest conventional weapon on the nuclear facilities. He's now kind of flipped over, you know, late May, he's saying, well, maybe we will do this, maybe we won't. Siena, I'm not absolutely sure, but it seems that this seems to be a part of his two-week horizon that he's talking about, that Joe, you talked about, that, you know, the so-called...
15 seconds.
Anyway, the 15-ton, you know, penetrating bombs that he's suggesting or proposing we would drop on, you know, those facilities.
Anybody want to add on to that?
I actually have a question for Alex.
Go.
I don't pretend to be a expert in Israeli politics whatsoever. But here's an idea I just want to run by you.
Yeah.
Isn't it good for the region and good for America if the two-week window expires and Israel accomplishes its ends alone? In other words, is it not good for the region? Is it not good for geopolitically if Israel is no longer seen as a client state of the U.S., if they emerge as they're already a power, but a more formidable power acting without U.S. assistance in the region? That's good for world stability, right?
Well, it's an excellent question. It would be good for world stability. However... Netanyahu specifically asked the U.S. Defense Department to provide weapons that Israel itself does not have.
Right.
And so they want, very specifically, this 15-ton GBU -57 penetrating bomb.
The so-called MOAB, the mother of all bombs.
The mother of all bombs, which Trump has this kind of grim fascination with. He's talked about it during his first administration. And so I guess my point is that, you know, we cannot assume that all political actors in Israel are necessarily interested in this, the kind of autonomy that you're speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are other parties within Israel who are. But, you know, the ruling coalition at the moment does not endorse that. And the ruling coalition's favorability ratings in Israel are 48%, which are not very, is not very good. So, yeah.
And so I think that, I think all of these indicate to me that everyone is leaning, in, everyone in that area, if they're not, he doesn't have a high approval rate for what he's doing. It indicates to me that we're in that situation that I'm speaking about, which is that everyone's concerned about what happens afterwards.
Right.
What happens? I think everyone agrees that, you know, Iran should not have nuclear weapons. I think everyone agrees that. But I think everyone worries about what happens in that vacuum. What happens afterwards? What does that look like? And I think that's the hesitation for a lot of people.
Yeah. For me, again, it's a legitimate concern. There's always, you know, unintended consequences of every policy lever that you pull. But it's at present, for me at least, it's a second order concern.
Well, I think that one, you know, thing that can happen is that, you know, Trump essentially wants to see some kind of collapse of the political establishment in Iran.
Sure.
But then what happens afterwards? Are we going to get some kind of MAGA style, you know, modern dictator. I mean, a dictator in Iran who sort of pushes, you know, further modernity and some reforms as a kind of a sop, you know, to people who are concerned about the political future, you know, of Iran. And then all of this in order to make deals with a new Iran that's more pragmatic. I mean, there are all sorts of, I think that one, the major destabilizing factor is Trump's transactionalism. On one level, he's very pro-Israel, or so he says he is. On the other hand, there's this split between him and Netanyahu as far as Iran is concerned. And how is that going to play out in the long term?
Alex, surely the most destabilizing force are the mullahs.
Sure, they're a major destabilizing force, but I don't know. I mean, he's not taking a clear-cut position about what he wants to accomplish in Iran. That's what concerns me. That's what it's, I think. Bottom line, you know, I think all of us here agree that it's not. You know, nobody wants Iran to have full nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
We all agree in that. But the problem is, you know, what form is that new government going to take? And you know, is it? Will it be? Well, we'll see.
I don't know. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Perhaps.
I mean,
you know,
and it's not my job to defend this or any elected official, the president or any elected official.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's unusual, by Trump standards, clarity on the goal here. And it's Iran must not have a nuclear weapon, period, full stop.
Yeah. I think.
But I feel like I'm getting that message from the White House. You're not hearing it.
I am hearing it.
Okay.
I am hearing it. But there's goals are one thing, means are another.
Sure.
I'll bite. It does seem muddled, though. It does seem like there was a back and forth, and I will.
It's still Donald Trump, for Pete's sake.
Well, I know, but that. Well, right. That's the point, though, right? I mean, it's from the White House. I do think that it is. I understand what you're saying, but I also I don't think it's always very clear because there's, you know, the statements like, well, I'll make my decision one second before I tell you.
Yeah.
and that kind of thing that makes it much more difficult to fully realize what's on and off the table.
I used to be a fifth grade teacher, and one of the things that to this day my fifth grade students, you know, now well into their 30s, I'm sure will say that Mr. P used to say all the time was, you know, not every thought that comes into your head needs to come out of your mouth. Donald Trump was not one of my fifth graders. Let's just leave it at that.
Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel yesterday morning. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.